You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Advances in the Delayed Onset of Type 1 Diabetes, Strategies to Improve Awareness and Care for the Practicing Clinician. I'm joined today by Dr. Fran Kogan, Director Emerita of Diabetes Services and Washington National's Diabetes Care Complex, and Professor of Pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and Diabetes at Children's National. She's going to discuss ethnic, racial, and socioeconomic differences in patients with type 1 diabetes. Welcome, Dr. Kogan.
Oh, thank you for asking me to be here.
We hear a lot about disparities in type 2 diabetes, but not as much in type 1. Can you discuss this? What do you see in terms of those ethnic, racial, and socioeconomic disparities in this population?
I work at a ethnically diverse children's hospital, and we have a mixture of all populations, including African-American, Latino, and undocumented immigrants, as well as a Caucasian population. And we know that care is not necessarily always equal. We have many difficulties in terms of getting patients to the clinic due to underlying issues such as work jobs and the ability to take off from work and get time to come to the office. We have transportation difficulties just to get to clinic. We have food insecurity, and which doesn't play a role in how we deliver insulin. In addition, there's so much technology now with type 1 diabetes that there's an issue with access to the technology as well as having a computer. Many families don't have computers and rely on their cell phones for communication. And then there's the language barrier, and this all plays a role in management of type 1 diabetes. So it's not just type 2. And we found, especially after COVID, that there was a huge increase in DKA, especially affecting ethnic minorities.
You bring up a lot of interesting issues. Let's dive into a few of those. Let's talk about the technology. I did read some studies showing that it is out of reach. What does that mean if you're dealing with type 1 diabetes and you can't get a pump?
This is a daily occurrence. And first of all, even I just want to mention, which is something to keep in mind, that many of these pumps that we now use with many, many patients, the studies were done mostly on Caucasian children. So there's a lack of diversity in even these pump studies. So the issue is obtaining the pump. So first you have to look at insurance. And in patients that are privately insured, you can definitely get one of the pumps, and usually of your own choosing. With the Medicaid population, we struggle to even get pumps approved. And then they may only approve one kind of pump when the family wants another. So that's part one. Now with the pumps, we need to have communication with the continuous glucose monitor. So that also needs to be improved by the insurance company. And if you're going to use a continuous glucose monitor, you need to be able to use a cell phone. And many people can't afford cell phones, although we know you don't necessarily need a cell phone plan. So that's, in terms of technology, just the first barrier is just getting it. And then once you do get it, many of our patients fall off the communication. For example, with one of them is Dexcom, and another is the Libre. And then we have the ability of our hospital staff to communicate based on URLs and looking at, we can just go online and look at what people are doing. Seems to be a lack of the ability to do that. And even understanding how to do it. A lot of it is language barriers. We're very fortunate to have a community health coach at Children's who we receive through philanthropy, who will often guide our Spanish-speaking patients on just how to get set up and how to set up these accounts. So it's language, it's getting to clinic, and then there's also teaching. You have to be able to teach families how to use this technology, even though theoretically, you know, you could take a module, but many of our patients can't do that, and they have to come in for teaching. And then they say, well, we can't get the time off. So technology, that's just those factors. The last factor, which we all succumb to, is implicit bias. Many of our docs and healthcare professionals say, oh, well, you know, these kids can't use it because for whatever reasons. And that's a terrible thing to have. And we have, and there are studies that show this. So we have to get past that as well.
Yeah, implicit bias in the healthcare system is a huge problem. So because the technology isn't as available, I'm assuming you did mention higher rates of DKA after COVID or during COVID as well. But even in non-pandemic times, I imagine you're seeing much worse blood glucose control. What does that mean for these children and adults?
Well, clearly, way back in 1993, I have to mention the Diabetes Complications Control Study, which showed that intensive management will decrease the risk of complications later on. So we now know the American Diabetes Association recommends a target A1C 7 or under, as well as if you're using a CGM, time in range of 70. So these are things that we are seeing many people with higher A1Cs who have erratic use of this continuous glucose monitors, and those that don't have continuous glucose monitors that use meters, which are, still happens, minimal glucose testing. So if you're not testing often, that means I can't help you lower your blood sugar based on either sliding scales or correction factors. And we don't even really use sliding scales anymore. And we use correction factors.
So then long-term, do we see higher risks of complications in these populations?
Well, the truth is we do. Sadly, those that develop type 2 diabetes have a more quicker pattern to develop complications than those with type 1. So that's another area. But yes, we do. We start seeing, as children have longer and longer exposure to type 1 diabetes, we start seeing beginnings of autonomic neuropathy. In some of my teenage boys, we were seeing a little bit of erectile dysfunction. And then we worry about retinal issues later on, as well as having the beginning of what we call nephropathy, which is reversible. We check random microalbumin to creatinine ratios in these kids. And if they're abnormal, we immediately get them on medication. So yes, we're always concerned and we're always screening for them.
One of the big things now in type 1 diabetes is screening for autoantibodies. And again, looking at this population, is this something that we're seeing, ethnic minorities or immigrants able to access or understand?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned this because yesterday I had a patient who came in, her routine, a little 12-year-old girl for her routine diabetes follow-up. And mom brought her son, who's 14, and mentioned to me that their pediatrician says, oh, by the way, my son has an A1C of 5.8, and he says he's going to get, if we're not careful, he's going to get type 2 diabetes. So I looked at her, and I said, oh, my gosh. I said, I'm glad you brought him. So immediately, they have Medicaid, by the way. Immediately, I ordered antibodies, which I did right in my office. I immediately put him in my system. I did not charge for the visit, and I had him get the 4 antibodies and repeated the A1C. I then spent, separate from my appointment, and unfortunately it was lunchtime, so I could do this and explained why I got this so that if he has dysglycemia along with the antibodies, I could put him on this medication, the teplumazab. So I explained this to the mom and she was on board and I got the antibodies. So there you go. I mean, it's a matter, and clearly the healthcare provider, and this is why we're working with pediatricians to talk to them about screening. So that is very important, especially in first degree relatives, if not everyone. I should say 90% of the population do not have family histories of type 1.
Yeah, I've been talking a lot about screening with a lot of the experts who are crossing their fingers for population-based screening at some point. Why do these disparities exist?
In terms of access?
Access and quality.
Well, I'd like to say it's usually financial for those reasons. It's access to care and also understanding the healthcare system in the United States. If you go to other countries, like in Scandinavia, there's universal healthcare, and it's in fact, they have better A1Cs than we do. So I think if you ask me, it's a matter of finances, and it's also a matter of access and understanding the healthcare system. So how do you get by this? You try to have multidisciplinary teams in your office or your practice who can reach out to these families who may not otherwise have the ability to communicate with you. So we have social workers. I think it's very important to have social workers, psychologists, community health coaches to work with families that have difficulty either understanding the language or getting themselves to the office. So why? I think it's just not necessarily, I worry it's the United States healthcare system.
So there's not a lot that our primary care doctors or endocrinologists can do about the healthcare system, but what can they do about implicit bias?
We actually have to take a course. So at Children's Hospital, I've had to take several modules and courses to understand how to work with implicit bias. The reality is, and this is very sobering, is we all have implicit bias. And it's not that you're going to make the implicit bias go away. It's being aware of it and working against it to say, don't say that you can't have, how shall I put this? What I'm trying to say is that we need to include all ethnic backgrounds in both research and in the ability to receive technology. And we need to be aware of it and not just assume, Caucasians will do better with the technology.
Or assume that if a child comes in with poor control, that it's blamed on a lack of education or that they're Black or anything like that.
Right. So that is very true. And I think it behooves the healthcare provider to kind of dig in and find out what's going on, right? And that's why I should also say for our adolescents, we have them do PHQ-9 surveys to look for anxiety and depression. Because clearly, if you are depressed, that should, and perhaps have suicidal ideation, you know, the diabetes is important, but we've got to deal with mental health before they're going to improve their diabetes care. We also need to find out why there's high A1C or poor control. Maybe moms or the parents are working all day and there's no care at home to help with insulin administration or glucose monitoring. So we need to find out why.
That's an excellent answer. And one final question I have for you on the epidemiological side is type 1 diabetes, are there any differences in presentation or incidence in non-Caucasian individuals?
Yes, it's increased. It's highest in African American. That's highest. And then I should still say the Caucasians have the highest incidence of type 1. However, the incidence is increasing more so in African American and Hispanic populations.
Any idea why?
I don't know why. I really don't know why. We do know that you have to have a genetic predisposition to have the possibility of getting type 1, and then something in the environment triggers it, right? So this is the time where I finally understood necessary and sufficient. It's necessary to have the genetic alleles aligned in the HLA complex, but not sufficient. You have to have something in the environment that's triggering it. And one of the things we clearly know that triggers it are viral illnesses. So we know COVID did a number on many people. The flu did it, and then 10 years ago, another H1N1 did it. So I wonder, is there just more exposure to the viral illnesses? Who knows? So I'm not aware of any reasons why.
That's fascinating. It really is. Well, anything else that you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Yes, I think a good way to summarize this is that equality does not mean equity, okay? I just want to say what that means. Equality means the same treatment for everybody. Equity means fair treatment based on the needs and requirements of others. So when we say equal, it doesn't necessarily mean equity.
Can you give me an example explaining the difference between the two?
Yeah, I can. I'm going to have a mental picture for you. Say you're at a baseball game, okay? And you have people who are in a wheelchair, people that are 6 foot, and then you have a 5'2" person like me. They're all allowed to come to watch the game. It's all equal admission. However, you need to have the ability for them to see the baseball game. So the person with the wheelchair has been given a means to rise up so they could look over at a certain height. I've been given a step ladder so I can see above. And then the 6 foot person can see easily. So what I'm saying is that's why you have to have accommodations along with it so that everybody has just, fair and just treatment.
Fabulous. Now it's very clear in my head. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you so much. It's been fascinating. And I think it's a topic that we don't talk enough about in medicine. And I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. I hope you'll listen to another episode from this series. We have four other podcasts, each on a different topic. And I also want to say that this podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. In support of improving patient care, MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. And I want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Sanofi US, who provided an educational grant for this activity.